So, as you may have guessed, I'm not Phil Terman. And you can confirm that by getting a copy of this wonderful... So you can confirm that by getting a copy of his wonderful new and selected poems called Our Portion. There's like a photo of him in the back. And this is not the first time that Phil has had an encounter with sort of potentially confused identities. He tells a story that goes something like this. I'll probably mangle it. But he was in a cab in New York, and the cabbie starts looking at him and going, like, You Salman Rushdie. You Salman Rushdie. And Phil's going, no, I'm not Salman Rushdie. He said, no, you Salman Rushdie. So a couple years later, Phil got to go hear read Salman Rushdie read, and it was a while after the whole fatwa thing, but there was still a pretty strict rules. You had to go up in a long line up to the front, and you were supposed to not talk to him. You were just hand him your book, his sign, he hand it back. And Phil goes through the long line, and of course he breaks the rules, and he tells Salman Rushdie his cabbie story, and Rushdie signs the book and hands it back to him, calls kind of solemnly, and he says, "Better you than me, man." So in a way, I kind of wish I was Phil. He's such a fine poet, and he's funny, and he's very wise, and he wears the mantle of poet, I think, a little more easily than I do. I'm going to start with a poem that kind of gives Phil's take on that. It's called Job Description and Poet. Isn't it my job to loaf and lean at the table, to nap at inconvenient hours? Aren't I getting paid to speak inappropriately, to remain silent when pressed? To avoid meetings? Would you rather me be punctual? Would you rather me answer the phone? When the snow arrives, I'm paid to stick out my tongue. When the light bulb shatters, my task is to describe the dark. Don't expect me to always return to the same chair like a dog to the same tin bowl in the corner of the kennel. I sleep while others are awake. Am awake while others sleep. When you point to a plane, I'm staring at the moon. When you point to the moon, I'm digging the earth with my teeth. I'll sign your petition with my epic. Don't follow me unless you want to go somewhere else. Don't be surprised if I respond to your chastisement with an embrace. Or if I claim paradise from my dung heap. Or if I continue to talk long after the wind has spoken its last elegy. The reason Phil's not here this evening is, and he does send his greetings, is that he's caring for his wife who's recovering from some surgery. So I thought I'd share a poem of his that is kind of a love poem of him, in part a love poem from him to her. And it's called Alternative Ten Commandments. Thou shalt walk with your love on summer evenings before supper to the pond with the many peepers. Thou shalt sit in silence and listen to deep-throated trills chorusing their frog spirits from homes of leaves and sticks and water. Thou shalt observe the gradual emergence of the Big Dipper, star by star. Thou shalt not long for anywhere else. Thou shalt clear the mind of affairs of business and duties. Thou shalt look from the ground to your lover's face and press your lips there and your tongue and open your face to your lover's lips and tongue. Thou shalt not be afraid of flashing lights of deer spotters and broken pickups. Thou shalt slowly rise and, bopping to the frog song, shimmy to the pond until the wheat fields swallows your shadow. Thou shalt fulfill the frog's longing and make your bodies bare and slide into the water and glisten. Thou shalt remain until your heartbeats slow down and the moon appears above the surface. Well, Phil's Jewish heritage is, you know, very meaningful to him. It's kind of a golden thread that runs through his family history and through his life and through his work, his writing. Of course, he's not a traditionalist. We've given some readings together where we sort of talk about our lovers' quarrels with our respective religious traditions. This next poem is the fourth poem in a series of poems that kind of grew out of a trip he took to Spain, where he was kind of exploring the history of Sephardic Jews. During sort of, there was a whole period of intellectual flowering and religious coexistence on the Iberian Peninsula, followed by the Catholic reconquest of Moorish lands, and then followed by the expulsion of the Jews in 1492, and then a period of great Inquisition and torture called the Auto de Fe. So this poem kind of brings together Phil's Jewish mother and his own deep love of books and the 17th century, great 17th century philosopher, Baruch or Benito Spinoza. Spinoza was left with his family from Spain during the expulsion, and he was later excommunicated from his own synagogue in Antwerp for his supposedly heretical views. So this is called from Spinoza's book on God, of God, I'm sorry. My mother took these books out of the park synagogue library and never returned them. These books on Halevi and Maimonides and Spinoza and the secret Jews. She snuck them out the way she'd wrap dinner rolls in napkins and secure them in her large black purse. And so I'm writing about these Jews she'd want me to honor, though when I was 13, I sat and stood and sat and stood beside her during the service and suddenly turned to her and said, I don't believe this. Did she imagine that nearly half a century later, I'd struggle late summer morning under a glassy sky with you, Benito, though I'd rather call you Baruch, another non-believer who, in your book of God, says that the more we know God, the more we love him, and how it's all about essence, and he doesn't live in the synagogue, somewhere else, out there, in the earth, somewhere else, in here, the soul. I don't believe this, we both declared, for which I received a sideways squint, and you got excommunicated. Though clearly we believe in something, clearly there's a perfection somewhere, the absolute stillness of this early afternoon deepening in its mixture of shadowed light. God, you said, like nature, is infinite. There's a slight quivering of honeysuckle, an afternoon, perhaps, like the one on July 27th, 1656, when you were damned by a proclamation signed by your own people, in accordance with the decisions of the angels and the saints, with the approval of the Holy God and the entire congregation. A child, as you mastered Torah and Talmud, you heard the auto de fe screaming through your window. So, to your own mind, you submitted, excommunicating yourself before they could excommunicate you. As for me, to my mother, I paraphrase Dickinson. Some keep the Sabbath by going to synagogue. I keep it staying at home. But she didn't command me out of her presence. She didn't denounce me to the congregation. She didn't before God declare, cursed be he during the day and cursed be he during the night. Instead, she gave me these secret books and the memory of her hidden bread. Because you never know, she'd whisper, you never know when you'll be on your own. You preferred grinding glass, the clear, fine dust. a bedstead, an old Turkish robe, a few pair of socks in need of mending. No stone, no marker, just your 111 books arguing what the prophets claimed, that to know God, it is impossible not to love God. You renegade, you defector, you transgressor, you Jew. Another deeply moving series of Phil's poems is a series that's called To a Scientist Dying Young. It's a set of seven elegies written for his brother, who was killed right in his prime. He was an extraordinary scientist, and he was killed while he was out running and hit by an automobile. So I'm going to read just two poems from this series. The first one is called Washing the Body. I wanted to wash my brother's body, the way he washed mine, as children, in the bath, squeaking and splashing, his older hands soaping my tender skin. I wanted to touch him one last time, not the way I brushed his chest when he lay exposed in his injury, his breath rising and falling to the rhythm of the machines, but rather to anoint with wet cloth his freckled face, around his blue eyes and small mouth, to work my way down the shoulders and chest and stomach, sponge his thighs and the hairs we both inherited from our father, and from his father all the way back to our first hairy father. And so I am cleaning them too, if what we are is some portion of what others leave. And I wanted, while reciting from the Book of Songs, to clean his nails and brush his hair and recite the prayer of forgiveness for touching him so, and to sprinkle holy soil onto his flesh and place broken pottery on his eyes, to wrap him in unbleached linen and place him in the pine container, readying him for his next experiment. So this is the fifth of the seven elegies, and it's just called What We Own. And I was talking to John back there, and he's from Cleveland. This poem has a little bit of Cleveland in it. I followed you down the switchback trail of the Grand Canyon, and we slept in a crevice, and we own that. And we own those moments tossing the football in front of 4073 Wincote Road, until the streetlights snapped on. And we own the smoke bomb the cops threw at us and a few thousand others at the Jefferson Airplane Concert, Akron, Ohio, 1972. And we own the whole country we passed through, all the way to the ocean, where we checked into a hotel and you discovered, lying atop Gideon's Bible, a black film canister's worth of weed and a half a pack of rolling papers. And we smoked it, and it was good. Unbelieving of our luck, which we own, and the lunar landscape surrounding our tent in Big Bend, Texas, and the stars, so clear we could read by them, and did. And we own The Godfather, Part One, on the big screen of that packed theater in Evanston, Illinois. And we own that fear when we were lost in the Tennessee woods into the dark, and you followed some analytical instinct until we found, lo and behold, a road. And Bob Dylan, who was ours, and Joan Baez, who was also ours, singing The Times They Are A-Changing at the War Memorial. And watching the Indians, miracle of miracles, beat the New York Yankees at Yankee Stadium during the 1955 heat wave. That too, that victory, was ours. And I remember how quiet you sometimes were. And I asked about it, and you said, it's a feeling you get. You don't know how to talk about it. And I'd like to think we own that feeling, how we bested the myths. We didn't become murderer and victim. We didn't cheat on the other's birthright. Oh, my brother of the other world, my brother who perhaps will greet me when I arrive at that place prepared for by our Father, who is now joined by his own flesh and blood, which is not blood, which is not flesh, but bones, and perhaps spirit, which we believe in, like the moon, or the unpredictable Cleveland weather, or the way the snow descends on fallen leaves, or how the sun glazes them now for their moment, stirred in the slightest wind, the same wind that blew the Jerusalem dust in our faces, which we own. Well, what I really cherish most about Phil's work, and which keeps me returning again and again to his poems, is his clear-eyed affirmation of life in all its complexity. A big theme for him is the garden. His wife's a great gardener. And I'm going to read the opening sections of the long title poem that's from the Torah Garden, but it's also, of course, in, where did I put this? Also, of course, in our portion, which I hope you'll pick up. The poem starts with him sounding the shofar for the Jewish New Year. And if Phil were here, he'd actually demonstrate it with a real ram's horn. The poem then jumps into early spring and moves through the cycles of the year back to Jewish New Year in the fall. So this is just the opening sections here. The Torah Garden. I sound the shofar for the new year, and in this suspended time, my life is focused in my mouth, lips on the ram horn I purchased in Jerusalem, rending the air with its broken notes, summoning us to renounce. Fashion a kingdom, it says. Open yourselves up to the only moment there is, this stillness, this garden, hanging like the last blast of its bellowing breath. Late afternoon on a Saturday, designated the day of rest, and so this writing is a sin against the deep powers of silence. It's difficult to think of transgression on a day so full of early spring. Four ducks splash landed on the pond, and the daffodils are lifting their bulbs, announcing their bursting. No rest for the robins who gather their twigs and bits of grass. None for the lettuce seeds that grow under the grow lights, already thrusting their green spears through soil. Certainly no respite for the laborious pounding of my heart as I spy you dressing in a circle of sunlight. Your flesh flushed by the love we've just made, according to some commandment. The world acquires flavor only when a little of the other world is mingled with it. So I borrow Rick's beat-up, uninsured, rusted-out truck and shake and bump my way to Watson's horse farm, where Jack, the owner, barks back his huge Rottweiler, then climbs up into his front loader and gestures with his tanned left arm out the window for me to follow toward the small mountain of manure, motioning for me to back up. And I have to force the shift into reverse, Jack lowering the loader's claw into the steaming pile and lifting it, smoke curling as if just removed from the oven. I position the truck. The black magic rains into the bed. One, two, three loads, all this junker will hold. Fiddling with the country dials, I pull out and onto Scrubgrass Road, hauling our new earth, pulsing with all the ingredients of creation. All right. This last poem kind of brings us back to the issues of confused identity. It's set in New York, where Phil lived for a while, and it's called Albert Einstein at the Soup Kitchen. Do I look like anyone? He asks, as he swoops his long spoon into the peas, lifts it a few inches and holds it steady to pour onto the tray of the next famished mouth, shouts to George for more as the supply empties down. I'm the bread and donut man in this assembly line of volunteers who gather for our 3 hours of weekly service and socialism. Jose, the finger-pointing Filipino, who pours the punch and repeats, The wages of sin is death, and only reads paradise from the comedy. For his description of heaven, he says, and light. Jake, the Buddhist, who scrapes the dishes as they are returned, saves whatever appears untouched for someone else's insatiable hunger. Sal, who tells me he was on the other side of the line, meaning he was one of the thousand who form every morning single file around this Church of the Apostles, up 9th Avenue and around 28th Street. Like a snake, he chants, looking out the window beyond Crack Park, cursed above the beasts of the city to eat dust all the days of its life. And their eyes are filled with dust, drugged and sleepy, bodies stiff from sidewalk cardboard sofas. The pea man, it turns out, looks like Albert Einstein, the shaggy white hair and white mustache, pronounced nose and dark, sad eyes. I'm an actor, he explains. They pay me to look like the genius. He shows me his card, E equals MC squared. Equity equals many characters. And I'm honored to be near even the resemblance of the man. Not because I understand relativity and the contradicting theories of light, but because of how steady he is with a spoon, filling each helping to the brim, as if each portion should be equal and abundant. On Phil's behalf, thank you.